Game over! Game over!
Here's Johnny. You're gonna need a bigger boat.
This is
so serious. What on earth? Roma!
I am Iron Man.
This is a tasty burger.
Welcome to the In Session Film Podcast.
Welcome to this week's extra film segment for July 3rd, 2019. I am Ryan McQuaid.
I'm Jay Ledbetter.
And thank you guys for coming back to us. Extra film in the new year. I'm so excited. And I can't wait. This is
2019. Woo!
And we're not drinking or anything. We're just here to talk about those small films or indies or classics that the main show normally doesn't have time to discuss. And this week, for our first show of the year, Jay, we're taking a step back from Aquaman and Mary Queen of Scots and big films, and we're going to talk about some really fascinating documentaries. And I think in the year that was 2018, some fascinating documentaries. A great year, by the way, for documentaries.
Mm-hmm, and absolutely.
The two that we're talking about are some pretty interesting ones to discuss, and that is Shirkers, the new documentary on Netflix, and then the newest kind of experimental documentary, Hell County, this evening. Like I said, this is our first show on Extra Film of 2019. Jay, how you doing, my friend? Happy New Year. How are you doing?
Happy New Year to you as well. I'm doing great. Yeah, we're really starting the year off with a big bang with these two small documentaries. And even worse, my final thoughts on a recent episode was about Hell County this morning, this evening, because I didn't think we were ever going to get to it. So if you listen to that, you already know how I feel about that movie and some brief thoughts. We're going to dig into it a little more here, but that was a mistake. So ended 2018 on a mistake, and in 2019, I think this is going to be the best year of In Session Film of all time. You got two just stellar extra film hosts who are probably the most popular host on the In Session Film Network, which I really like. I think they did a poll and we came out in first and second. I was first, you were second, obviously, but it's going to be great. I'm very excited for 2019 and what it means for In Session Film. It's going to be super exciting.
Yeah, I am looking forward to 2019. I feel like we've all kind of hit our stride, and it's leading up to episode 308 for our end of the year extravaganza, where we're all going to get together and do stuff and talk about our performances and top films of the year and all that. And I think from then on, you know, this show, that you know, and the main show, it's just going to be a great year in 2019. And speaking of the main show, episode 307 this week, the precursor to our big bash, will be an interesting review. It's probably Netflix's most talked about film of all time, if not the most talked about of recent memory, and that is Bird Box, starring my girl Sandy B and of course Jay's guy John Malkovich.
Oh yeah. So,
and
it's taken over the internet somehow. I don't know how it happened.
Yeah, I don't know how it has either, but it should be an interesting conversation, and they're going to be pairing that of course with their top five scenes of the year. And this week's poll, Jay, is an interesting poll, because I don't think many of us have ever discussed the best performances of Sandra Bullock. I don't really think all the time about her. She's one of these actresses that I feel comes and goes, but when she is on her A game, she's a fantastic actress. So this week's poll for Bird Box is the best performance by Sandra Bullock. A lot of good choices. Jay, since we won't be on that show, give me your thoughts. What do you think is the best Sandy B performance?
Looking over this list, I kind of realized I don't like very many Sandra Bullock movies.
Shame on you, Jay.
I know. Do you like? I mean, like maybe like three on the poll. I'm a really big fan of. Do you have more?
No. I mean, I like Speed and I like Miss Congeniality. I think it's a good romantic comedy. I think 2 Weeks Notice, the one film with her and Hugh Grant, I think that's a very charming film. I think that The Proposal's good. I think her with Melissa McCarthy in Heat, she does a really good job.
Oh, she's
that.
Good in Heat.
I think her performance in Gravity is really good. It's probably my favorite performance from her.
Yeah, though, it's hard to pick one other than that, because that movie was basically all her.
Yeah,
the whole movie was on her shoulders.
It's a little bit of Clooney, but it's her show for sure.
Right, absolutely. That would probably be my pick. I mean, that movie's really, really good. I can't remember being as engaged with a movie in a theater as I was with that one. One of the very few movies where 3D really added to the experience, so I loved that. And she's really, really great. I think there's a few issues with the script, but she does everything that she possibly can with the material that she is given in there. And I'd also like to give a shout out to, I didn't really care for Ocean's 8, but I thought she and most performances in that movie I thought were great. I thought a lot of other stuff was very lacking, but I think she and Hathaway, Blanchett, I think everybody is really, really charming in that movie. So shout out to that one as well. But I would pick Gravity probably.
Yeah, I would pick Gravity too, though. What would be a really good pick and make me pick other here is her performance in A Time to Kill, which is one of the, I think, better Grisham adaptations. And she gets to do a lot in that film with Matthew McConaughey. And I think her performance is really fun and just really good. And it's kind of a big coming out party for her. Obviously, then there's Speed, which is just a fun film. I love Speed, and her and Keanu have great chemistry. But yeah, I would say Gravity all the way, though we haven't mentioned her Oscar winning performance in The Blind Side, in a film that I don't think has aged well at all.
No, that was filmed right down the street from me, a lot of it.
Oh, really? So you were hanging out drinking lattes with Sandy B?
This was before I was here, but I like to go there every now and then and just pick up some of the grass that Sandra Bullock walked on, bring it home.
Well, yeah, as one
which
would
is it's at a high school, so everybody's like, oh, what is this grown man doing at a high school? And I say, don't worry about it, and I take the grass and leave.
All right, Jay. Well, you'll have to just figure out those legal troubles down the road. But for right now, we'll have to get into these documentaries that we're here to discuss. So without further ado, let's get into it.
And here we go.
You're listening to the In Session Film Podcast Extra Film Segment. Jay, when I was 18, the only thing I wanted to do more than anything was make a podcast.
Really shooting for the stars, man.
When I was 18, the thing I wanted more than anything was to make a movie. I had the idea that you found freedom by building worlds inside your head. That you had to go backwards in order to go forwards. But I never imagined it would end this way.
Whenever you're ready.
Now.
In the summer of 1992, my friends and I shot a road movie on the streets of Singapore called Shirkers. I was the screenwriter and played the heroine, a 16-year-old killer named S.
Did you feel it was childish?
Yeah, but that was the beauty of it, right?
That was a clip from the film Shirkers, the new documentary from director Sandy Tan. And it is a documentary that I found really fascinating, and it's going to be the big entry from Netflix. They usually have a documentary or two that they enter for the Oscars. Shirkers follows a woman exploring the events surrounding a film she and her friends began making with a mysterious stranger decades ago. Jay, when I watched this film, I found it to be absolutely fascinating. I could not wait to talk to you about this film. So what were your impressions of Shirkers?
You know, there was a lot of hype around this film from people that I talked to about film frequently. Film Twitter was kind of blowing up about it. Some critics were totally raving about it, and I found it maddeningly average.
Whoa.
I must say. These types of films are kind of a crapshoot. When you're making a movie and you say, I'm going to make a movie about X, there is a big possibility that you make something that is completely uninteresting when you dive in headfirst to something and just hope that, you know, you get the lemons to make the cinematic lemonade. And in this, I just don't know if the lemons were there. I didn't find there to be anything terribly intriguing about this mystery man that we try to find out about over the course of the film. What is his name? George Cardona, I believe. Mm-hmm. He's this sort of exploitative film teacher who the director Sandy Tan and several of her friends kind of he takes them under his wing to try and make this very experimental film in Singapore in 1992. And, you know, he's this very mysterious guy at first. He has this weird charm about him that draws in these young ladies to make this movie with him. And then he just, boom, disappears. And we slowly unravel some things about his past. And I was underwhelmed by the discoveries that we were finding out about him. I mean, to me, he was just like kind of a weird guy. And I found Sandy Tan, I found a lot of her narration to be kind of self-indulgent, and the entire endeavor to me a little bit was self-indulgent. And there are some brief moments in the film of self-reflection where her friends kind of confront her about why she is making this movie in the first place and the way that she acted when she was making the old film, which is called Shirkers. Back in 1992, they said, you could be like a real jerk. And there are times where she kind of says like, oh, wow, I was terrible. And I can't believe that I acted this way and these people are confronting me and calling me out on my BS. But then they, you know, just goes by, okay, swipes it aside and talks about how genius this movie of hers was. And that's another problem I had with it is the movie they made looks terrible. I mean, terrible. It was very much akin, what it reminded me of was actually another Netflix film, The Other Side of the Wind, which I thought was a really interesting movie, had a really interesting concept, but the movie within the movie, which we talked about this on Extra Film, was very frustrating because it was, I mean, I understand sort of what Orson Welles was going for, but, I was checking my watch when that movie came on. And in this, I was just, I was kind of mad at what I was watching because she is calling this like a work of genius and she's talking to these people from Singapore who are calling it a work of genius. And it's just like, she was 18 years old and she literally says in the description of the movie as some sort of like, insightful thing. She said, maybe it was a dream the whole time. And that was when I was like, oh, this is garbage. This is a 18-year-old student film. Like, this is absolutely terrible. And none of it looked terribly interesting to me. And maybe thankfully for her, there was no audio because I can't imagine that was particularly great either. It had the endorsement of George Cardona, who was, found out to be a complete snake oil salesman. So can't really take his word for it either. Another movie that I thought about while watching this was the documentary Tickled. Did you see Tickled?
Yes, I did see Tickled.
That was from a couple years ago, and I had a very similar sensation there. It was like, oh, there's going to be like a big crazy reveal here, and there's a build, and then kind of just a fizzle. And I think this movie is better than that movie. I would still say people should go out and see this because there's very interesting stuff. Structurally, I think some of the stuff she does is very interesting in this. It is spliced into the film are a bunch of old classic movie clips, which I thought was really interesting, sort of as a way to show the obsession of herself with cinema and kind of how it all has consumed her entire world and how it is hard to separate the things that you create with the things that you have seen and are influenced by. And that is especially true when she's talking about kind of the vision of George, who completely copies a scene, a great scene from Paris, Texas in this film that they were making, Shirkers. And that was an interesting kind of reflection on current art and the fact that we have so much film to be influenced by at this point, how hard it is to create something original and revolutionary. So I found that to be interesting. But as a whole, as the strict story that was being told, underwhelmed the way it was told, I found fairly interesting. So that's kind of where I stand on it.
Yeah. I really like this documentary. And good. I think also I really like Tickled. And I like the follow-up documentary HBO did.
I saw that too. I think
that is an interesting film and it's very frustrating. And I think that it's not a complete story, that documentary, because we don't have 100% answers. And I think a lot of documentaries at sometimes they don't answer all the questions because they don't have all the facts, but the stories are interesting enough for us to think about them, contemplate them. And hopefully with these stories being out there, we can have some closure down the road. And I think, you know, I thought about a lot about another documentary, Three Identical Strangers. That film does not end with all the answers. It doesn't.
That was a more compelling story to me.
I think it's very much the same kind of story in that film. And I'm not trying to get into spoilers for Three Identical Strangers, because you can go down a rabbit hole with all these films, to be honest with you, or any documentary for that matter. But with that film, what was interesting about it was you had these people that were lied to and manipulated, and they were going back and they were frustrated and they were angry and they wanted answers, and they used this medium to express that with the filmmaker. And I think what's different about this one is this is Sadie Tan doing it herself with her friends being interviewed who were there at the time, who weren't a big fan of George and his style of directing, what he did to people. It's very conniving, very mischievous, very untrustworthy. And yet the passion that this girl had, she was blinded by it. And she fell down a track that cost her so much financially, artistically, and it led to her many years later creating this film for Netflix. I found her story to be fascinating from a standpoint of not just from the story itself, but how this could relate to anybody at this moment. Plagiarism, ownership of artistic value, the way we treat human beings. It's a fascinating character study into somebody that you think you know, you think you can trust, and they take everything away from you within a blink of an eye. And the way that George, Mr. Cardona, takes advantage of these girls is awful. And to then find out, like you mentioned earlier, the audio bits were not there. It's heartbreaking. It's extremely heartbreaking, because while I agree with you about The Other Side of the Wind in that film, within that film, not looking really good and intentionally so, as we discussed, I think the film in here is, while it's not the most perfect film, and none of these first time director films like these are ever perfect films, it's still her first film. It's still the thing she wanted to do the most, more than anything in this world. It's something that she is so emotionally connected to, and everyone around her that were in the film was emotionally connected to, because it was telling their story of the place they lived in. And it was very much taken away from them by George. And this happens so many times, the idea of a con artist. I know it may not seem like an original story, but it continues to happen. And we hope that the world evolves and gets better, but it doesn't. And I found it to be a fascinating documentary. I was reminded a lot of Minding the Gap, also another documentary. We keep mentioning all these documentaries.
How dare you?
That connects the tissues, but that film is so personal. And when I watched Minding the Gap, I was not as invested in the first about 10, 15 minutes, like I told you in that review. of that film until the reveals, until where this film was going, what it was trying to say, what its message was. And that is, of course, about the pain and the hurt that all those boys have gone through in their lives and continue to either A, afflict upon themselves, or how they rise above it. This film, by the end of it, I felt so bad for Sandy and what she went through by George. I felt
boy,
bad.
Oh boy, is this a false equivalency, sir.
I felt bad for her friends, especially, and I felt bad for everybody involved, because to do something like this, to put yourself out there artistically, to take a risk, is an enormous endeavor. To have that stripped away from you to the point where you don't know if you're ever going to be able to recover and make something again is truly, truly heartbreaking. And I found it to be very personal. I don't think it answers every question, because I don't think we'll ever find George Cardona again. Some mysteries, we just, you know, kind of like the Zodiac Killer in Zodiac. We never are going to be able to find out who it is. We might think we know who it is, but we'll never find out and we'll never have closure. And I don't think that there'll ever be 100% closure, but I think this is the best way she could have that kind of conversation, is through the medium that she tried. And I think it's commendable that she got back on the horse and made this film. And I wish there was more with her friends. I wish they would have shown maybe more from back then, or maybe more, asked her more questions. I do think it's mostly about Sandy. And I think that there were others involved as well that got hurt. There's somebody that does the score for her film that he totally takes down a peg and destroys off camera. And it's based off of that guy's accounts of what George was telling him and how he was treating him. And I found that to be interesting as well. We get little nuggets, but we get also these other people that are involved with George Cardona. And I think he is an enigma, just like I think her film is kind of an enigma. And I don't think she'll ever have the answers for it. So I found it to be really fascinating, Jay.
Well, I'm not even going to go into how anyone could possibly equate the catharsis of Minding the Gap with the catharsis of Shirkers. So I'll just skip right over that, because that's that about broke my brain. But I would say when we're comparing it to Three Identical Strangers, which I have, this is a terrible habit I have of comparing movies. But
yeah.
The thing about Three Identical Strangers was that that had a payoff after the buildup. That exposed this systematic conspiracy. That wowed you. And, you know, you can't really do that if the facts don't line up that way, like this movie did. But what this movie, another issue I had with it was, and again, I think it's a worthwhile movie and there's a lot of stuff I like about it, but I think this could have benefited from a more objective perspective, because I think Sandy Tan, for a large majority of this film, it comes off to me as her thinking very highly of herself and her film from when she was 18 years old. And I really respected it when her friend, Jasmine, I believe is her name, who has gone on to be a fairly successful filmmaker, certainly more than Sandy. Mm-hmm. But Jasmine calls her out and they're like, the reason you're making this movie is so that you can put everybody else under the magnifying glass and just you enjoy other people thinking about this, and you want to see everybody else squirm just like you do. And that for me was like, oh, okay, this is good. Let's keep going down this road. And then she's like, anyway, my movie was great, and I'm so glad I got to blah, 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 blah. And it, another Netflix movie, I'm doing it again, but, what was the Jim Carrey movie, the Andy Kaufman,
Man on the Moon.
The documentary they made last year.
Yeah,
I know what you're talking about. I can't remember what it's called, but that ended up being tremendous potential, but it ended up being a vehicle for Jim Carrey to spout his philosophical nonsense. And so that ended up being kind of a waste of time. And this does not go to that degree of the self-indulgence, but there's some of that there. And I think it's really interesting when we the dichotomy between the two films we're talking about today, this one is as subjective as a documentary can get, and the other one is as objective as a documentary can get. So that's really interesting to think about. But did you get any of that from sort of her narration and her recollection of the stories and of her movie? Did you find it to be sort of endearing?
I don't know if endearing is the right word, Jay. I think the thing about this is it was her baby. It's her love. I mean, you ask any director about the projects they lost. I mean, you look at the Orson Welles documentary, you know, and you look at The Other Side of the Wind when he's talking about his films and the films he's lost and what they did to the Magnificent Ambersons and how distraught and how hurt he was by the studio cutting and, you know, destroying what he thought to be his great masterpiece follow up to Citizen Kane. And so it's really hard to say that I was 100% rolling my eyes or like, oh my God, you know, like you're not being objective about this, because I feel if you ask any director about their projects, they're going to be like, no, those are my babies. Even the bad ones, they're my babies and I love them. And I learn from my mistakes and I'm trying to learn.
Yeah, but she never talked about a mistake. She at one point calls herself a bad actor, I think, but she has like three critics on who talk about how transcendently good her movie is in them. And I would be okay with that if it was directed by somebody else, I think.
No, I agree.
You know what I mean?
No, I can see that. And I do think that those other documentaries that we mentioned, the plethora of which, beyond that Jim Carrey documentary that I do agree with you on, is a very self-indulgent film. Mm-hmm. Those all, for the most part, besides Minding the Gap, were done by different directors, taking a story and doing it. And why I like Minding the Gap more than this film is because it's not afraid to take itself very seriously and go and ask a question that could destroy a relationship. And she doesn't do that here, but I still find it fascinating in the journey and the sense of closure that she's trying to find. I don't think that there's a lot of closure in Minding the Gap as much as she's trying to find something. She's still trying to find answers. She's still bewildered.
I don't think
this.
There's much closure necessarily in either of them.
No, I think that there's more so here. I think she's trying very hard to find closure, because I think she finally got this movie back after so many years, after putting up with Cardona and, you know, his supposed death and that, if you want to believe that as well, because I don't know if you can buy that even, because he's just a crazy, crazy man that we didn't really get to meet. He's mostly kind of an enigma, or he's kind of this figure, if it were. And maybe there is more that somebody else behind the camera could have found. But I think that this documentary is very personal, just like Shirkers is very personal to her. And this is her story, and she's trying to tell it the best she can. I think she does. And I think while a lot of the Shirker stuff, I didn't think it was like this great Singapore, you know, film from what I could see. And obviously she got critics that were like, this is the great, great film that we never are going to be able to see, or we're never going to be able to hear. And you never know that. And I think, you know, films that we hear about, I think, you know, The Other Side of the Wind is that mysterious Orson Welles film that we talked about for years and years and years, you know, behind closed circuits. It was, oh, we'll never be able to see it. And then we saw him. We're like, oh, well, maybe it's not that good after all. So I don't know if we can really judge the film.
Who knows what other masterpieces George Cardona had at him?
Exactly.
We'll never get to know.
We'll never get to know. Maybe he took over the rest of the Orson Welles films that we have never seen. But I found the film to be very moving and touching, regardless of its flaws. And I personally think that Sandy Tan is while not the best documentarian or the best filmmaker or whatever, I think she tells her story the best way she can. And I will say one thing about that Shirkers film. There are these beautiful shots of old Singapore, the one she grew up in, the one that she was trying to film back in 1992. Mm-hmm.
It is kind of a nice time capsule, which she brings up. Yeah.
And I was going to say that the time capsule moment at the end, where basically everything is taken away and through time and it's been stripped down or it's been destroyed, these beautiful landmarks, it's very much, I felt, was reminiscent of how her life and her career or her trajectory or whatever you want to call it, was ruined by this guy. And
yeah, she had the brutal next step of going to Columbia Film School.
Well, I mean, she, if you know that the film's out there and it's being taken away from you, then I think,
She mentioned that she went from making a film to going to film school, and that felt, it felt like the wrong trajectory for her life. I get that.
She should have.
No, I mean,
she
should have had the opportunity to have this her just sitting somewhere in the ether to never be seen again.
Yeah, especially when you've had, whether it's, you know, praise to make you feel better or whatever it may be, you have this film that people are anticipating to see. And then they never get to see it. And then it becomes this mystery, it becomes this enigma. And then you go to school to see, okay, maybe I did something wrong. And maybe she didn't. We'll never know. And that's kind of sad. And I mean, it is where she does go. Yes, it is very privileged. And she got into an extraordinary place. But would she have gone there in the first place? I'll never know, because of the events. And maybe she went there and it was better for her because of the fact that, she didn't have to, go through editing processes or whatnot. And maybe she hopefully got better. And then she got to make this film and it's blown up and she's been nominated for a Gotham Award and it won a Sundance Prize and it's on Netflix and everybody can see it and everybody can see her story. And hopefully she can get some closure. Hopefully we can get a follow-up like Tickled and we can see if she, maybe she puts audio or maybe she refilms it down the road. You never know.
Cardona's alive, like you said.
Exactly. I mean, that's the cool thing about this film to me too, is that the questions leave me interested in the story to find out more down the road. And I think some documentaries, you just kind of sit there and you're like, okay, I learned everything I needed to know about this. Or in some documentaries, I learned everything I already knew beforehand. So nothing is interesting. Nothing throws it at me whatsoever. I think this one, on the other hand, is interesting. And if they had a follow-up, I'd totally be down for it.
I mean, that to me, that kind of speaks to the idea that you kind of wish there was something more. That's kind of where I am on it. But I will say there are some... I did like the end of the film where it's kind of this sweet... there is a nice moment of reflection where she does say, like, you know what, as horrible as this all has been, making this documentary has brought me together with all of my friends. And she says, I know I will never have my friends in the same room ever again, but they are all together right here in this film. And I thought that was very sweet and something really powerful about the potential of film, which I really, really enjoyed. So there's a lot to like here, and there for me was a lot to dislike. But overall, I would say definitely a recommend from me.
Yeah, and I would say the same thing, and I agree with you about the ending. I think it's very, very much reflected and hopeful, and leaves you with that sense of, well, maybe her and her friends, who within the moments of frustration talking about this story, can move on and find artistic.
I
want to
see Jasmine interview Sandy. That's
yeah,
what
I kind of want the roles reversed. Maybe that sequel. Like I said, maybe there's a reveal that you just don't know about yet. But I hope that all of these girls, obviously they're still going to be friends, but hopefully they're able to move past this and be able to tell more stories. And hopefully Sandy Tan is able to at least try and give us something to the audacious spectrum as what Shirker's mystery seemed to be. So Jay, any final thoughts on Shirker's before we wrap this thing up?
I guess I will just talk again a little bit about the use of the film clips in the movie as metaphors for the events that were going on in her real life. Early on, there's one where she talks about how Cardona's favorite film, one that he talked about all the time, was Fitzcarraldo, and how that whole movie was about at the expense of others doing something incredible. And that was how he lived his life. And that for a while was how Sandy lived her life, because she looked up to him so much. And there are other examples of clips from Bergman films, or like I said, the clip from Paris, Texas, speaking about how he basically totally stole that idea for a scene in Shirkers. And there's several other clips that relate to the disappointment she is feeling in some of the search for the history of George Cardona and her coming up empty in a lot of moments. So I really appreciated that. She's clearly very film literate. Her knowledge is clearly like vast. So I really appreciated that part. And I kind of like pointed out some movies that I was like, oh, you know what? I need to go see that. So I appreciated that very much. Definitely a very knowledgeable filmmaker. And, you know, she had a history as a film critic as well. So she clearly absolutely knows her stuff, which I thought was very cool.
Yeah. And as for my final thoughts, I do agree with you. The cut scenes with all the different films, it does feel like a true film lover, filmmaker, somebody you can tell that she was someone that and is someone that wants to continue in this medium and make personal
passionate
projects. And so I will also say that I was really fascinated by the backstory of Cardona. I think for all the people that he's manipulated and, you know, kind of backstabbed and crossed paths with over the years, I found that stuff to be some of the best parts of the film, because she wasn't interviewing people she knew and she was learning, I think, a lot in those scenes. And I felt bad for those people as well. I don't think in stories like this, there's any winners, and because of the events that happened to them. So, but I think at the end of this, I hope that there's closure for Sandy Tan. I hope there's closure for her friends and people that love the Shirkers. And I would be interested in seeing her do something down the road, whether it's a follow-up to this, whether it's a narrative film, whether it's a book, whatever it may be. I would be interested in seeing what she has to do next. And I think JD saw this film, and if he did, he would have more thoughts on letterboxd.com/insessionfilm.
And if you agree or disagree with any of our takes, you can let us know by commenting on our Facebook page, letting us know on Twitter, or you can send us an email at insessionfilm@gmail.com.
All right, everyone, coming up after the break, we're going to talk about a smaller film, but still in the documentary realm, and it's Hale County this morning, this evening. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
This podcast is a proud member of the LAMB Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
In a world where podcasts already seem to address every imaginable subject, one man broke new ground with a seemingly random obsession about exploding helicopters in movies. He was a podcaster on the edge, a maverick broadcaster who played by his own rules. Now, he has a last chance to talk about the strange way helicopters explode in film. Exploding Helicopter, available on iTunes and Podomatic now. Think you know about chopper fireballs? Think again.
Hello, In Session Film Podcast listeners. We take a moment to interrupt this daily programming to bring you the next Best Picture podcast, run by myself, Matt Neglia, where Michael Schwartz, Will Matheny, Dan Chiesese, Ryan C. Showers, and a slew of others, we are all on a search to find what is going to be the next Best Picture winner at the Oscars. Join us on our journey as we look at foreign films, documentaries, independent movies, as well as big action blockbusters. Everyone is a contender until they are not. Be sure to listen to us on all of the podcasting networks, including iTunes, SoundCloud, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, Player FM, and on CastBox. Be sure to come check us out on nextbestpicture.com, where we also have movie reviews, weekly polls, the before-mentioned podcast, as well as a lot more content revolving around the award season. Thank you so much for listening to me ramble. Now, back to JD and Brandon.
You're listening to the In Session Film Podcast Extra Film segment. Ryan, have you ever been to Hale County, Alabama?
I have, after seeing this movie.
Hey, hi, y'all. Got my bodyguard now. Got my bodyguard.
Grandmama gonna make some sweet potato pie and some cakes.
That was a clip from the latest film from Ramel Ross, Hale County, This Morning, This Evening. A very, very tiny documentary that is fascinating in its construction. The film is composed of intimate and unencumbered moments of people in a community and constructed in a form that allows the viewer an emotive impression of the historic South and Hale County, Alabama, trumpeting the beauty of life and consequences of the social construction of race while simultaneously a testament to dreaming. That was a very helpful summation of what this movie is because it's kind of hard to talk about. Ryan, you get the honor of going first. What did you think of Hale County this morning, this evening?
Why, thank you, sir, letting me go first on this one.
Absolutely.
I saw this movie twice because the first time I saw it, I was a little bit bored. Okay. Because I walked into this very blind. I think this is the most unconventional documentary I've seen this year.
It's fair.
And maybe I just wasn't in the right mindset. Maybe I wasn't focusing enough. And so in preparation for this, I was talking to you and JD about seeing this again because I needed to see it again because it had been a couple weeks since. And then I watched it again. And I thought it was beautiful. And I'm being very pragmatic in 2019, it feels like, about these two documentaries because they got me. And I think this one especially is really sad and it's beautiful in telling this story of this community. It is not really about two characters. I mean, we do see these two characters. We see this, we see Quincy, who's this young man and he is, more down on his luck, more povernistic. He's got kids and he's got a wife and they all live together with his family and whatnot. And they're more domestic life and they're kind of stuck. And then there's Daniel, who is this kid, who is this all-star athlete that is trapped within the system of the environment in which he's in. He's trying to break out of it with his talent. And I think what Ross does as a director and as a photographer and as an artist here is use those two boys as caveats into this community to show the most realistic version of the African-American experience in America going on right now. This doesn't have any politics. This doesn't have any kind of, I really think, social message. This is just showing you what it is like for someone to live in this povernistic area of this race. You know, because we don't really see any white people in this film. We see maybe one or two at a church that everyone goes to. That's about it.
Mm-hmm.
It is a predominantly African-American community. And they're beautiful in terms of their day-to-day lives, how they're there for one another. Through praise and through tragedy, through fun, how accepting they are of one another. There's a scene in which Ross and his film crew go to this old house, which was probably a slave owner's house. And they pass through these cotton fields.
Yeah. The cotton field shots are
it's a lot. It's scary good. Scary mm-hmm. good. Because they play audio of the basketball game, of the cheerleaders, of the people in the background of them driving through these cotton fields. And you wouldn't at times know that there was any difference in terms of the way they live and how you see their lives. It's almost as, it's not as bad, but it's not any better than what it used to be. They haven't gotten to that big house. You know what I mean? They don't own mm-hmm. those houses. They you know, just oppose that with shots of old black and white kind of Al Jolson, you know, Birth of a Nation kind of looking blackface actors.
Right.
Much like Black Klansman does in that scene, only it's not for entertainment value. It's to show you that this is kind of, in a lot of ways, representative of this community and what you might think of, but it's not what this is about. This is about a community of beautiful people. And back to that tire scene, the guy that he is talking with, who is burning tires and kind of getting all the scraps together, there's a scene of just the fire and it just showing the smoke and it's rising and rising. And you just hear these conversations throughout the film of how these people are just very warm and loving to the idea of talking to this guy. And the player and Daniel is too. And so is Quincy and his family for the most part. And besides Quincy's wife, I believe. And we get all kinds of crazy access and it's really interesting. There's a lot more to talk about this. It's only like an hour and 10 minutes.
I think it's like an hour 15, hour 20. Yeah. It's very short.
It's very short, but we get a more intimate look at a community than I think any documentary or any fictional film has done all year. And I was completely surprised by this film and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. I echo so much of what you said there. I think it is an absolutely beautiful, beautiful film. And, the very first thing you see in the film is kind of these text saying exactly what this film is and what it's about. And very early on, you see text that says he's a photographer and a basketball coach who decided to just like start recording and see what was going on in his community. And it says, "Photographing in my day-to-day, I began filming using time to figure out how we've come to be seen." We, of course, I believe, meaning the African-American community, specifically poverty-stricken African-Americans in the South. And exactly like you said, this gives you as intimate a look into a group of people as you could possibly imagine. And it shows you how the echoes of the past have kind of put the community in the place that it is today. I went to college in Alabama. I am familiar with Hale County to an extent. I haven't, you know, really spent a significant amount of time there or anything, but I know of it and kind of its reputation. And this is very reflective of the kind of things that I've heard. And the beauty of it comes from the sense of community. And you see these young high school kids still with all these hopes and dreams of, athletic glory specifically because he is a basketball coach. And you see these people just practicing and practicing and practicing. And he has these very extended scenes of these kids practicing. And you really get a feel for how hard they're working to achieve their dreams and getting out of Hale County in the only way that they think they can get out of Hale County. And you see the sweat and you see how hard they're working and they are absolutely exhausted, running around, dribbling, shooting. It's really great. And apparently he had 1,300 hours of footage that he cut down to 80 minutes, which is really, really remarkable.
That's insane. That
it's
is
crazy.
Insane.
Yeah. It's wild. But even with that, I don't know that he needed any more than that. Mm-hmm. He really engrosses you in this community absolutely perfectly. It is utterly transportive in my opinion. On a scene-by-scene basis, there's nothing particularly immersive on its own, but the quilt of the moments has the capacity to absolutely overwhelm you, which is what this film did for me. There are some moments of true tragedy, not just kind of this innate sense of sadness or circularity or stagnation in the community, but as a whole, most of this stuff is kind of mundane, but you get a sense for these people because of the conversations they have very casually. There's one scene where a man is talking to another man about police interaction, and he said, "I'm going to make a movie about a world without guns, where mm-hmm. the police only have spears. And when they have spears and they hit you anywhere but the heart, you get to live another day."
Yeah.
That's crazy. I mean, that says everything you need to know from the mouths of the people who experience it, you know? Mm-hmm. And it makes so much more of an impact because of the very intimate nature of the film. It's very passive filmmaking, but extremely effective filmmaking. It again is the exact opposite of what Shirkers is doing. This is a total fly on the wall. They interact with him very rarely, but for the most part, it's just him observing, and I loved that about it. And there's all there is to talk about with this are the very small moments that make this tapestry, this beautiful tapestry of a certain kind of people. And I love those movies like Minding the Gap, like Hoop Dreams. This is very Steve James inspired. Even, ironically, still about basketball, because that is mm-hmm. such an important part of these. We've seen it in Hoop Dreams in the inner city, but now you go to these more rural southern communities and the ideals are still very much the same. The way that these people, these kids, are able to get out of this impoverished area, this horrible, stagnant poverty, is by doing athletics, because they can't afford any of the other ways to get out. And so it is so important for them because you just get such a sense for what they're going through. And I absolutely love that. It's incredibly impressive. And I hope that Romel Ross gets to do other stuff, because he's proven that he can make an experimental documentary with the best of them. So I want him to go on to do whatever he wants, because this is a beautiful, beautiful film.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about a lot of the scenes in here. As much as I think Daniel scenes, who's the basketball player in here, those scenes are kind of barely what we're focused on. We're more focused, I think, on Quincy's family and a lot of that, mundaneness, but respectful look into that family's life. This is very respectful. It's not,
absolutely. Yeah.
Especially when tragedy hits this family, there are moments, and I think that this is my problem, and I think a lot of people's problems when they watch a film, and it's kind of what you were mentioning with Shirkers, is like there's a moment in the film and you're just like, okay, this movie's going to turn and it's going to focus on that and it's going to be blah, blah, blah. No, it's and Ross is like, no, we're not going to do that. No, this is not what this is about. It is not about some expose, or it's not about this, huge, like, how are we going to fix the problem and stuff like that. He's showing you by this family and this community, the problem may be beyond this community and something that needs to be fixed bigger in terms of poverty, in terms of race, in terms of, like you said, gun violence towards the African-American community, opportunities for them to grow within the world. Those are beyond mm-hmm. their control.
Education.
Education, especially. Living conditions, there were living conditions in this film that broke my heart, and mm-hmm. to find out the tragedies behost onto this family, you can't help but wonder if they had better living conditions, would they have had that tragedy? If they had better situations. Quincy mentions he's making enough money just to go back to work, can't enjoy his life, because beyond working and working and working, he's with his kids, and he barely gets a time to have a break. How fortunate I am to do this show, how fortunate I am to do half the things I am in this life, and to watch somebody who can barely afford to take a rest, because he has his hands full with that beautiful baby girl of his, Kyrie, who we get to see run around a lot over and over and over again in the film, and she is a cute one, to say the mm-hmm. least.
Absolutely.
And shows that there's true hope. in these communities, and there's, and that these kids are the future, and they're energetic, and they're
and these
wise.
Are kids who are completely they are oblivious. Free of the knowledge of the world around them and what troubles probably lie ahead for them, which is tragic but also kind of beautiful in the innocence that these little kids have.
Yeah, and I found a lot of these smaller scenes to be so effective, and I think the scene that kind of broke me a little bit was when Quincy was talking about a dream that he had, and he was talking about how he was afraid of choking. And I won't give into the reasons why he had that dream, but this isn't a dream just about choking and his fearing of what happened. But also this tragedy, it felt so much more than just that. It felt bigger than all that. It was about, he feels that at any moment in his life, he's not going to be safe enough, that he can't just sleep in his bed and he can't just have a normal life, and they're never going to live a normal life. And he's always going to be worrying about his kids, and he's always there for his kids and everything. It's truly heartbreaking. And I really like this film, Jay. And the more I think about it, the more I want to watch it again. It's not something I'm going to put on all the time.
It's not something you put on just as you're falling asleep or anything like that.
But man, Ramel Ross just, I would be fascinated to see a longer cut just so I can have more of these people and see more of their lives. It's so respectful. That is the one thing I could say about this film more than any other thing. Respectful of these people, respectful of this community. And, you know, I'm not saying that a lot of documentarians aren't with their subject matter, though they take advantage of it for the, you know, the overtopness or the story gets ahead of them or whatnot. But damn, this movie is just respect.
Yeah.
In a 85-minute, 90-minute form.
Absolutely. And I just want to bring up one more scene, I guess. There's a terrific scene in just the locker room of the basketball game. I guess they're waiting for a game to start. And some of the music that they play in this movie is terrific. Mm-hmm. And this scene especially, there's this very ominous kind of industrial droning beat kind of playing as these high schoolers are just in the locker room waiting for the game to start. And you see most of them sort of just contemplative and sitting in their chairs, but you have a handful of guys who are like wrestling on the couch and almost getting in fights. And that in and of itself kind of says so much, because there are these people that, I mean, this is the way that I kind of interpreted it. You have these people who are sort of accepting their surroundings and know that what they are in for, what their futures hold. But then you have these other guys, these guys who are trying to fight. I mean, as a bad metaphor, they're trying to fight their surroundings and try and get out. And it also plays into sort of the hyper-masculinity of the community and things of that nature. And the music just adds so much to it. And it's just those scenes that play out. They're very long. They're very drawn out, but it just engrosses you, and it's really, really great. But Ryan, why don't we get into some final thoughts here? What are your final thoughts on Hale County this morning, this evening?
I think as we're getting towards the end of the year, it's going to be hard not to be talking about this when we're on episode 308. I don't know if it's my favorite documentary of the year, but the more I think about it, it's really, really good, and it could climb up my list by the time we talk next week. I will say that going back to that scene, I think it is the scene of the movie, to be honest with you, which is the long take on the cotton fields. That is one of those images, those scenes this year that is going to stick in my head for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
Ramel Ross has made a documentary that at the end of this year has made me question every other documentary I've seen this year in terms of its quality, because this isn't a documentary. This isn't a narrative film. This is art, and this is a true artist putting it on form. I cannot wait to see what he tries to do next. And yeah, I would say if you got it near you, see it, watch it.
For sure, I don't know how it's for everybody. I don't know how this is going to be available. I mean, I'd be if it is available at a theater near you. You live in New York or LA?
Yeah, probably. I would say this is going to be one of those when it comes to stream. See it. It's not for everybody. But I think if you really want to understand communities like this, you need to watch this documentary. To fully understand the African-American experience going on right now that is not being told in the news, because not everything is glorified. It's as simple but yet as tragic as you might think. And it really makes you think. And so it's a great movie. It's a great movie.
It is a really great movie. And it's been, you know, here I am, a white guy talking about the best films about the Black experience this year. There's been a lot of movies this year that have made me, at least in my own mind, kind of rethink my impression of that community and what it means for me to be a white guy in a world where all of this stuff is happening, with movies like If Beale Street Could Talk, with movies like this, with movies like Black Klansman, and a handful of others. So, I mean, it's been a really great year as far as me kind of as shaping my ideas about the world. I mean, that's the power of film right there. And this is another one that goes right hand in hand with so many of those other fantastic movies. But my final thought, and this is going to be unexpected, I'm going to talk about Danny Glover, because Danny Glover was one of the executive producers on this film. And Danny Glover is a terrific producer these days, making some of the most interesting movies around. He executive produced the small film Capernaum, which is like one of the most revered indies. It's coming to my theater soon, so I haven't seen it yet, but it's super revered. He produced Zama as well, which is one of my favorite movies of the year, and several other really small films. Danny Glover's just thrown his money around at crazy movies that he wants to see made. So shout out Danny Glover, one of our greatest film minds going these days. So thank you very much, Danny. But those are our thoughts on Hale County this morning, this evening. If you want to hear more of our thoughts, you can go to letterboxd.com/insessionfilm.
And again, we'd love to hear your feedback, guys. If you agree or disagree with our takes, leave us a comment on our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram page, or send us an email at insessionfilm@gmail.com. And with that, that's going to do it for this week's show. And like I said, just a friendly reminder for all of you guys to go follow us on those Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram pages. We'd love to have those conversations on the internet with you and talk about films, especially as we're getting closer and closer to talking about our end of the year stuff. And with the new year starting, we'd love to have new listeners along with our regular listeners and conversations. And you can also email us at insessionfilm@gmail.com. We respond to every single piece of email that we get from you great listeners out there.
Absolutely. And be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, or SoundCloud. And while you're on iTunes, please, please leave us a review. We would greatly appreciate it. Our podcasts are syndicated every week at geekcastradio.com, the Podfix Network, and the LAM Podcast Network. Also, check out our Listen Now page on our website at insessionfilm.com/listen-now.
And the In Session Film Podcast is supported by our awesome listeners like you listening right now. If you want to help us out, you can go over to our website at insessionfilm.com and click on our main menu to find our bonus content tab, where you can hear our bonus content for just a small donation of 99 cents. I still think that the bonus content that we have that is the most recent is the Mary Poppins bonus content that you and I and JD did.
Yes, I believe that is correct.
I feel like there might be some bonus content coming on down the road, so might want to go over there and find out about that bonus content, guys. You can also check out the In Session Film Store, where you can find all our In Session Film swag for 2019. Want to step into the new year with a shirt or a hat or a mug or whatever you'd like.
I've got a great shirt.
Yeah, great shirt. Super comfortable. Maybe a hoodie since it's getting a little colder and we're getting in February and January, of course, obviously right now and still in those colder months. Or you can just go to insessionfilm.com/donate and you'll see all of our information there on how you can help us. You can also hear all these great shows that we do. I do Chasing the Gold, we do Extra Film Here, and of course the main show. You can hear all those on our mobile app for just a one-time fee of $1.99. You can find that app in the Amazon market for Android devices, the Windows 10 store for Windows devices, and the Podcast Source app for iOS devices. You can see all of those details at insessionfilm.com/apps. So that is going to do it this week for Extra Film. Of course, obviously, the main show this week is going to be episode 307 Bird Box and the top five scenes of the year. Can't wait to hear what Brendan and JD have for those lists. The lists that they've been doing so far have been pretty interesting. I've agreed with them on some takes, not all the takes. But Jay, let's get into some final thoughts for this extra film segment and get out of here, bud. What are your final thoughts for this episode?
Loyal listeners will know of my horrific dental history. 2018 was a real rough year for me as far as oral surgery goes. I had just the most horrific wisdom teeth extraction of all time. Had two sessions overall, probably about 3 hours. It was a absolute disaster. And yesterday, went back to the dentist because I broke a tooth.
Oh, no.
And I had to get a crown put on. So, you know, 2019, starting out great, just like last year on the dental front. And it is so annoying because right now I have, like, the temporary crown on, and I get, because they got to mold the real one, and I have to go back in 3 weeks. And the temporary one sucks. And I hate it, and I can't stop tonguing it all the time, which then just makes it hurt. So my life is harder than anyone else's, and nobody can convince me otherwise. I hate it. So that's it. You know, that's Jay's complaint corner for this episode of In Session Film.
If you couldn't hear it, guys, I was playing a violin for Jay in the background. As for my final thoughts, I don't have anything to really talk about. I don't think I should mention this.
I'm leaving. I'm taking my headphones off, and I'm leaving.
I am so proud of my Texas Longhorns this week. Whooping up on them Georgia Bulldogs in that Sugar Bowl. It feels so good to have 10 wins after 10 years of not having that. Such an accomplishment by this group. I'm so proud of these boys. I mean, this is the proudest I've been of this program, of the head coach, of players, in quite some time. I think this program is back on the right track. I think we're going to be right there in that big conversation next year in terms of national championship and Big 12 championship. I think we can do that. We're bringing back pieces. We're another great recruiting class. So shout out to my Texas Longhorns. Shout out to Sam Ellinger, who Jake Fromm, the quarterback for Georgia, said would get beat if he ran like he did in the Big 12 all year by that defense. And I think he laid more of a whooping on that defense than even some other defenses in the SEC or other quarterbacks have. I think Georgia was, like my fans were saying in the stands, overrated. And I think we are in a great place. It's great to be back on that threshold. I love my team, and it just feels so good to win. It just feels so good when everyone says you're not going to win a game, and then you go and prove them all wrong. And also, shout out to Bevo for setting the tone.
That was great.
True MVP right there. And I don't care what anybody says about Bevo. Bevo's going to stick around. He's been around longer than all of us, this tradition. And if you got a problem with Bevo, why don't you go take it up with him? Because I'm sure he seems like in the mood right now to argue with people.
He seems very argumentative right now. But that seven-point win was pretty cute. I mean, my boys, my Auburn Tigers, won by 49. So I think I'm pretty sure the NCAA just sort of retroactively gave them the national championship after that performance.
I think we won
the Music City Bowl, the esteemed Music City Bowl. But, you know, at least we won our bowl. Whatever. I don't know. Football's terrible.
Yeah, at least, you know, we didn't lose to Florida. You know what I'm saying? Anyway, just pointed that out. Anyway, thank you so much for listening to Extra Film this week, and we will see you guys next week.
From the Podfix Network. You can check out more shows like it at podfixnetwork.com.